I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Happy 4th of July. Today on this archive edition of Midday, since the 1990s, a centuries-old trust in the basic notion of expertise has been eroding, so that in more and more instances, public discourse is driven by feelings instead of facts. What are we to make of our increasing proclivity to trust sensation over evidence? Can individual anxiety in an uncertain and unsettling world extend to the collective geopolitical realm? William Davies is a political economist at the University of London. His latest book is called Nervous States: Democracy and the Decline of Reason. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take your calls and emails. William Davies joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. My guest today is William Davies. He's a political economist from London who has written a fascinating and compelling book that examines the distinctions between mind and body, war and peace, reason and feeling, and how respect for and reliance on expertise has eroded over the last few decades. He writes, quote, that reactions against expertise may seem like an irrational rejection of truth itself, yet they are more often a rejection of the broader political edifice from which society is governed. It's not just truth that is at stake, but the manner in which feelings of security and trust are generated. Here in Maryland, we've had multiple encounters with issues of trust among public officials, a mayor who resigns, and amid allegations of self-dealing, a former police chief who began serving a 10-month prison sentence on Monday, a delegate who's in prison for accepting bribes, another who uses racist epithets and remains in office. And of course, we have a president for whom stating truths is more often than not inconvenient. Voters are whipsawed, uneasy, fearful. And in such a state, Will Davies asserts that they come to rely more and more on feeling and less on facts when living their lives, casting their votes, viewing their world. And it's not just individual citizens, it's governments too. Davies demonstrates the lineage between personal and collective angst and how it's transforming democracies all over the world. The book is called Nervous States: Democracy and the Decline of Reason. William Davies joins us from the studios of the BBC in London. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I have to tell you, this book is terrific. This is one of the most original, compelling, and persuasive books that I have read in a long, long time. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much.
On it. I'm just very, very impressed and moved by it in many ways. Let's start with these fundamental distinctions that you write about that really became part of the common parlance in the 17th century, and they are between mind and body and war and peace. What do you mean by that?
Well, in your introduction, you highlighted, I think, quite an interesting aspect of our current political moment, which is that the lack of trust in the institutions of the state seems to have gone hand in hand with a lack of respect for what seems to be rational, evidence-based views of the world. And what I was interested in doing is looking at the origin of both of those things, because I think those do have a common history. And if you go back to that moment in the mid-17th century, really at the birth of the modern world as we understand it, when the scientific revolution was underway, but also when our current understandings of the nation state, as we now understand it, was born in that moment, really with the kind of end of the religious wars of that tore Europe to pieces in the 17th century. And in terms of those distinctions, I think what's very important to understand is that what reason originally offered at that precise moment was not only a way of rendering the physical world knowable and governable via science, via mathematics and geometry and so on, but also a way of trying to pacify society, to turn it into something that could be governed according to principles of reason, rationality, and rule of law. But at the outset, those two distinctions, that the mind is not part of the physical body or the physical world, and that the peace is something that is legally distinct from a state of violence or a state of war. These distinctions are the kind of governing principles on which modern liberal societies would subsequently depend. And as one of those distinctions starts to dissolve, so does the other one. They seem to be things that co-evolve in certain ways.
And in what ways are the distinctions, for example, between mind and body dissolving?
Well, I think this distinction, which is a philosophical one that is most famously associated with the French philosopher René Descartes from the 1630s, this has dissolved at various moments in history. And I think that the birth of psychiatry, psychoanalysis, and psychology in the late 19th century originally was one way in which people first of all started to think about their minds as being influenced by their bodies in various ways. And the whole notion of an emotion, which is such a powerful concept in today's world, that we think of emotions as increasingly important in the way we shop or in the way we vote or the way we interact and so on. But an emotion is something that has long been understood as something that affects our minds via our bodies. But I think that the last 20 years or 25 years or so, there's been a particular moment in this collapse of mind-body distinction, partly with the rise of the neurosciences, where we increasingly attribute our thoughts or our decisions or our feelings to our brains rather than our minds. But I think also that the way in which our bodies are kind of readable via digital technologies and the kind of the growing infrastructure of surveillance that surrounds us means that our bodies are constantly giving off cues about how we're thinking, how we're behaving, what our intentions might be, and so on. So I think we now live in a society where Descartes' distinction between mind and body is no longer really deemed to be credible. We might say that it's had various moments of crisis in its 350-year history, but I think that it's now something where we increasingly attribute our thoughts and feelings and decisions to aspects of our body just as much as to our minds. And these terms don't really have the same distinction that they once did.
Yeah, of course, Descartes famous for saying, "I think, therefore I am," drawing the connection that way. And then when it comes to the notion of war and peace, the title of your book is Nervous States, how individuals and governments are in this sort of state of constant uneasiness, constant trepidation. And it's because the nature of war itself has changed dramatically. And what was once a weapon, what was once never even imagined as a weapon has been used as a weapon, like a van driving down the street or an airplane crashing into a building.
Sure. Well, I mean, those examples are of the kind of, I suppose, the growing asymmetric nature of warfare, particularly in the 21st century, in the context of the war on terror. And the war on terror has generated all sorts of strange new types of violence that don't fit tidily into categories of military intervention or civil policing. You know, drone warfare is a sort of mixture of police surveillance and military strikes, in the sense that it's seeking to target individuals a lot of the time. It's a type of sort of sort of criminal surveillance as much as it is a form of military intervention. But I think that, I mean, that the title of the book, Nervous States, I mean, I'm interested in this notion of nervousness, because in some ways the title is a pun, because it's about political states in a state of anxiety, but also that our psychological condition is one of nervousness. But this idea of nervousness is one that interests me throughout the book, really, which is that I think that we are increasingly primed to react. We are, and this comes back to the question of knowledge in society, that our political and our psychological condition is increasingly one where we are heavily attuned to immediate changes in our circumstances, in our environment, in ways that historically, if you go back over centuries, has been a condition that has been increasingly far more frequently associated with states of war or states of violence, or what the philosopher Thomas Hobbes called the state of nature, where we are very well primed and technologically equipped to react to change the entire time, but far less equipped or far less psychologically disposed to a slower, calmer, more reasoned, dispassionate way of seeing the world. And in that sense, I think that the kind of very boundaries between states of peace and states of violence have come to seem less secure in various ways. And I think that really the contemporary terrorist strategies are precisely to bring about that kind of dissolving of a very clear boundary between war and peace, and which has effects not only on how we understand war, but also has effects on how we understand peace. And I mean, the other contemporary example of that would be the alleged activities of Russian interventions in elections via types of information war, cyber war, types of interventions which their primary purpose is to undermine the sense of trust and of public civility that liberal societies fundamentally depend upon.
William Davies is the author of Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Thanks for joining us. You know, of course, the nature of warfare as it's changed from the 17th century, you know, obviously the Napoleonic Wars or the Civil War here in America were conducted very differently than the First World War and the Second World War. And one of the observations I found really fascinating that you make is that the introduction of aerial bombing in the Second World War, which wasn't part of the First World War, led to this heightened state of alertness and nervousness that hadn't been known before. In the First World War, I think you say that 5% of the casualties were civilian. All of the other casualties were military casualties. And then that number rose dramatically in the Second World War. And now, as warfare is affected and executed, it's in the 80 percentile. So civilians all of a sudden in the Second World War in London or Berlin or wherever had to worry about bombs flying in from the sky.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, this is a very important point you raise. And I think that, I mean, one of the things which I'm interested in the book is how the technologies of war and the weaponry with which war is fought changes how people have had to know the world and encounter the world and experience the world. So Napoleon, going back to the beginning of the 19th century, developed all sorts of ways of moving around troops and equipment and information at much higher speed than most of his adversaries were able to, and that was a kind of crucial source of advantage. Now, aerial warfare is really crucial because, for starters, it turns the emotions of the civilian population into a very important military resource. It also, it's aerial war that led governments to first become really interested in what we now call gross domestic product, GDP, because aerial warfare during World War II was as much targeting industrial infrastructure, economic capacity, as it was military resources. And it was also targeting civilian morale because it was seeking to weaken the resolve of the mass public to engage in a war effort. And I think, I mean, this, although the United States didn't come under the same kind of bombardment, I mean, the need to mobilize a civilian population during World War II around the production of munitions and various military resources and so on is absolutely crucial. So the Second World War was really, I think, the first war which was as much a conflict between whole peoples in that way. And it was particularly in Europe, aerial warfare that was crucial for raising the priority of emotions. So nowadays we talk about democracies and political mobilizations as things which draw on people's feelings and sentiments and so on, but that was a kind of key step. And the other thing I'll just briefly to say about aerial warfare, which is so important, is that it's once war becomes fought in three dimensions that the need to come up with some type of artificial intelligence is first triggered. And it was the emergency of World War II that led to this huge investment in the computing development of digital computers at MIT and Stanford during World War II, because what computers originally promised to do was to augment and enhance the human capacity to predict movement in space. That, you know, going back to the 17th century, Thomas Hobbes was fascinated by the movement of bodies in space in the 1640s, but he didn't have to do it in real time with bombs flying in from all directions. And the development of the computer was specifically to turn that distinctively human capacity to model physical objects in space, but to allow that to be done in some type of real-time, very fast-moving environment. And I think that's a kind of crucial change in the status of reason in human society and subsequently in politics.
Yeah, and that whole notion of immediacy and the need for information right away, each of us, even as individuals, you know, are terribly frustrated when we turn our computer screen on and it takes 5 seconds to load up. Lots more to talk about, in particular, this notion of the erosion of trust in expertise, and we'll pick that up when we come back from a break. William Davies is a political economist at Goldsmiths, University of London. He's the author of many books. We're talking about his latest, Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. We'll have more with Will Davies after a break. We'll take your calls and comments here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, an inspiring story of self-belief and self-determination. Baltimore-based activist and entrepreneur Chris Wilson joins me here in Studio A to talk about his memoir, The Master Plan, My Journey from Life in Prison to a Life of Purpose. The book chronicles Wilson's incredible and improbable journey from a lost teen sentenced to life without the possibility of parole to a man who orchestrated his own emancipation through education and who continues to pay it forward through his advocacy and mentorship. Chris Wilson on Second Chances and the Redemptive Power of Grace, that's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is William Davies, a political economist at Goldsmiths, University of London, where he's also co-director of the Political Economy Research Center. His latest book is called Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. You're welcome to join our conversation if you'd like, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to drop us a tweet @MiddayWIPR, and to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHall. WIPR. So, Will Davies, the reaction against expertise, the erosion of trust in expertise in a variety of areas, science and other political areas as well. You say it may seem like an irrational rejection of truth, but it's more often a rejection of the broader political edifice from which society is governed. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the first thing we can say is to actually look at some of the kind of polls and surveys done in this era, which is that actually trust in science is not in great trouble. Of course, there are people who don't believe in, you know, the people who flat earthers and all sorts of people who believe all sorts of things. But the areas where there is a very serious crisis of trust in many liberal democracies, including the United States, but also in across Europe, is trust firstly in elected politicians, but also particularly in journalists and the media. And I think one thing which is worth kind of remembering is that the kind of anti-expert politics that we see around us at the moment, and you have things like the anti-vax movement, which is becoming quite a problem in particularly in Mediterranean Europe, but across many countries in the world, is that it is, as much as anything, it's a rejection of policies and a vision of government which foregrounds expertise and knowledge. I mean, particularly where, you know, we had the Brexit referendum in 2016, where the anti-Europe campaign was accused of not respecting facts and so on, and they didn't in lots of respects. But I think that what we've begun to work out over the last sort of rather painful nearly 3 years is that what was being rejected was not really kind of truth so much as a vision of politics in which the kind of smart people tell everybody else what to do. And I think that it's that kind of technocratic project that has really entered a crisis in the last few years. I don't think that, you know, the trust in science and including climate science is actually holding up reasonably well. It's more the status of knowledge in society and the politics surrounding it.
And you talk about if we want to understand the forces that are pitted against expertise today and the forms of knowledge and feelings that threaten to discredit experts. We need to consider politics from a different perspective altogether. So not as the alternative to war, as Thomas Hobbes hoped, and again, he's the 17th century philosopher, but as an ingredient in war. So how do we come up with a different perspective altogether on politics?
Well, I think that we can't think that, and I think this is now widely understood, is that that facts don't speak for themselves. Facts also need to be couched within credible institutions that that represent people in a democratic sense as well. I think that this is obviously very difficult, but I think partly what I'm appealing to it there in the book is to take seriously the new types of mobilization that are operating not just on the right. I mean, I think that there are forms of mobilization on the left and there are forms of green mobilization, but which see politics as something that affects people in a more sort of, well, yes, in an emotional sense, but also in some respects, one of the things I talk a bit about in the book is that politics, some of the kind of divides that we see in our societies now have become matters of life or death to some extent. There are kind of key existential issues about things like life expectancy, about people's quality of life that are kind of more fundamental and cannot necessarily be always necessarily represented purely as in terms of facts and figures. We need to take seriously the fact that politics needs to engage people in their full emotional and embodied selves and not simply assume that experts and a sort of more kind of technocratic type of politics can govern in a legitimate fashion.
Yeah, data and statistics are good only so far. They don't really take individual, the notions of individuality, or they can't lead to an understanding of individuals. They can lead to an understanding of other things. The book is called Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. My guest is William Davies. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And Will, if we could, we'd like to go to the phones to Stephen in Severn. Welcome to Midday with William Davies.
Hi. I've seen a great concentration of wealth, I guess like the rest of us have. And I was wondering how you account for capitalism and privatization and the destruction of unions in this anti-democratic wave that we're seeing.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question, and I think that I suppose there are a couple of ways in which capitalism shapes my analysis in the book. One is that I think it's worth realizing how important inequality has been to the kind of fracturing of a sort of expert-led view of the world. And I think that, so you take the United States, we now know, thanks to statistics of the work of the economist Thomas Piketty, that 50% of Americans have had no increase in their real income since the late 1970s, which is an astonishing sort of reality. But this is masked by these indicators about GDP growth. So GDP can rise by 2 or 3% each year. Meanwhile, when you've got half of society having no increase in their real income in that time, this is, I think, I mean, exactly what this goes on to explain is another question. But I think these are inequality has really kind of undermined the authority of statistics in society. And there are similar examples like that I talk about a bit in the book in Europe in relation to some of the other kind of indicators that technocrats like to use to demonstrate that progress is being made, but actually don't tell the true story at all. The other thing which I discuss in the book is the rise of a kind of the way in which capitalism has undermined the authority of expertise and of objective knowledge by increasingly integrating it into the marketplace. That, you know, increasingly, and this is the vision of the neoliberal economists such as Milton Friedman and others, was that really that the market will become the greatest source of truth, and that the best way in which we can establish progress and we can understand the world is to create a free market for knowledge as much as anything else. So universities are increasingly encouraged to act like market actors. Entrepreneurs are considered to have the sort of real insights into what's really going on in the world. Consultants become a sort of, you know, providing putting a market price on objective expertise. And this has also done, I think, great damage to the status of facts in society. So I think you're absolutely right. I haven't talked about some of the other things you mentioned, like trade unions and so on. But I think that this is a story about capitalism as much as anything else.
But you do also write about the privatization of knowledge, how that these think tanks and in some cases corporations, they are collecting data that they're not sharing, that they're not willing to put out there, because it's better for business, for their business, if other people don't know those facts.
Sure. I mean, that this is the sort of fundamental schism running through the book, is that the ideal, I'm not saying it was ever entirely realized, but the ideal of that early modern idea of knowledge was that truth can provide a basis for us to all agree with each other. That was what people like Thomas Hobbes and others hoped, was that truth would be something that we could hold in common, and that way we would stop fighting each other. That was the kind of starting point of liberalism, if you like. Now, what happened with the rise of corporations in the late 19th century was that knowledge became a source of competitive advantage. You had in-house research labs in these companies like General Electric and Siemens and so on, and that was the starting point towards the kind of crisis of public knowledge that we now face in the context of Silicon Valley, where the whole point of all of that data that Amazon and Uber and Facebook are collecting about us, the last thing they're going to do is share it publicly, because it is the very basis of their competitive advantage against each other. So there is a kind of anti-enlightenment dimension to capitalism, where knowledge is treated more as it is, I suppose, and this is the other point I'm making in the book, is that knowledge becomes a bit more like military intelligence, i.e. something that has to be kept secret so as to gain an advantage over some kind of rival, whether that be another corporation or another entrepreneur or whatever it might be, and that knowledge becomes a weapon to resist competition and to fight off foes, rather than a basis for public agreement. I mean, there's an astonishing detail about Facebook that I mentioned in the book, which is that Facebook has developed this special app which alerts it to any interesting new startups that are emerging in its own, what it considers to be its market, whatever the hell that market is, so that it can quickly buy that company and very often just close it down. But this is a sort of an approach to knowledge which sees it as something that is a sort of a kind of dog-eat-dog world of knowledge becoming something that is used against others rather than a basis for a shared reality.
Yeah, and even the notion that knowledge is ownable. I can own this knowledge if I buy this company.
The whole notion of intellectual property, I think, is a very interesting one in itself. And, the fact that we talk about intellectual property in this rather kind of as if obviously this is a possible thing, is something that I think is deeply questionable.
William Davies, the book is called Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. We have an email from David. It's a long email, but he says the concept of what is truth in public discourse may be the fundamental issue of our time, perhaps determining if we humans survive in the long term. He alludes to people who, for example, assert creation science should be given an equivalency to evolution or global climate change or the anti-vaxxers, as you had mentioned earlier. Here in Maryland, our governor was elected largely on his ridicule of what he called the rain tax, which is a way of dealing with stormwater remediation. Our democratic society, according to David, needs to embrace science and truth over rhetoric and false beliefs. But you write a lot about the very nature of what we know of or consider truth, and you say that the power of facts and expertise to settle disputes conclusively appears to be in decline. Is there any way of stemming that decline and turning the graph in an opposite direction?
Well, I think I share that the emailer's concerns, and I think he's absolutely right, particularly when it comes to something like climate science, where we hear these horrific projections of how the next 30 years could turn out if we don't act quite drastically. I think that what it is a mistake to think that the facts speak for themselves. I mean, I'm critical of thinkers such as Steven Pinker, who effectively sort of, and I think this is also true of some of the kind of new atheist thinkers such as Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens and so on, who sort of believe that reason can sort of clobber people into silence or submission, and just sort of you know, that science doesn't need to sort of justify itself almost. I think that what I do think is that scientists have got to get a lot better at explaining why they know what they know, and what processes are involved in them knowing what they know, and trying to demonstrate the advantage of knowing the world in that way rather than some other way. I think that often science ultimately depends on trust. The entire edifice of science depends on scientists trusting one another, but also on those who report science being trustworthy and so on. So science is a political project. Science can only survive, and science can only reign in politics through the safeguarding of all of the relationships of trust through which different findings get recorded and reported and shared and passed on and so on and so on and so on. And I think that although there is a whole branch of science policy studies and efforts to understand science communication, and there's now far more attention to things like cognitive biases and why we believe what we believe and this sort of thing, I think that the need to kind of make science much more transparent to people, and to clarify the ways in which it seeks ultimately to rescue us, is absolutely very pressing right now.
You write that there's hardly a political figure more likely to arouse justified suspicion than the professional truth teller who has discovered some happy coincidence between truth and political interest. There is a political dimension to what we assert, each of us individually and as governmental entities, what we assert as truth. I mean, and statistics, and I was fascinated by the etymology that you pointed out. The first official statistics agency was established in Paris in 1800, and the early clients were states, therefore it's called statistics. I thought that was interesting. But this notion that we have we can not bend the truth, but we can employ our data to our political end.
Well, yeah, I mean, the first issue of something like statistics is, what do you even measure in the first place? I mean, I mentioned GDP earlier as something that emerged out of war, but equally, I mean, you know, in Britain right now we've got a situation where the government is boasting that the unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in over 40 years, and that's not false, but it does conceal the fact that underemployment, non-employment, involuntary self-employment, but also in-work poverty are all far, far higher than most people would like. So some of these kind of statistics, you know, the question of which statistic you treat as being the kind of important one or the representative one of or the one that is the sort of the vehicle of progress is itself a very important one. I think that that's one aspect of that. The other is, I think, that the way in which the commercial dimension of expertise, to go back in a way to the previous question about capitalism, has become so problematic in the last sort of 20, 30 years or so on, is that there's a kind of market for expert advice. And this was kind of fundamental to how the global financial crisis took place, was that within Wall Street, there were all sorts of auditors, credit raters, economists, some of them working for universities. If anyone's seen the film The Inside Job, you know, some of the people who come out of that film worst are faculty economists who are being paid very large consultancy fees in order to say that various economic financial derivatives or financial markets are far more secure or less risky than they appear. So I think that there's been a lot of sort of, I suppose, quite cynical instrumental use of expertise numbers in public life and in commercial life, that often I think people have lost interest in trying to understand which are the really credible ones and which are the ones which are more difficult. And of course, that provides a huge opportunity to anyone who wants to effectively just use numbers as purely rhetorical devices to say, well, you know, and that's when you enter a kind of a post-truth environment, is when someone can say that the stock market has grown by this much when actually the facts are something else altogether. I think a lot of people are now quite numb to the authority of numbers, because really it's very difficult to be able to distinguish which are the ones which are really worth paying attention to.
going to take a break, but before we do, I want to have you respond, Will, to an email from Blake. This is an interesting question. How do you see the effect of literature as opposed to news and social media on reason and sociological behavior? Is it different now than it was at the time of Thomas Hobbes in the 1600s?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I've never been asked that before. And
yeah, you don't write about that specifically, but it is something to think about. Yeah.
It is interesting. I mean, I suppose... I mean, my book, and obviously this is much easier said than done, but I suppose my book is I suppose it hope expresses the hope that we can find ways of we can rescue the alternatives to the real time data cycle. I suppose that our nervous state is one where we can know huge amounts about what's going on right now from various platforms, various news channels, various things, but our ability to actually achieve more enduring portraits of the world is perhaps in decline in certain ways. Now, literature, you would say, should be part of the latter. That literature, that Shakespeare tells us truths about the world that have endured over centuries in a way that a Twitter feed or something like that does not. So, I suppose that one would hope that literature can hold up a mirror to the world. I mean, Hobbes and Descartes believed that maths was the source of all enduring truth. That everything that is permanent about reality comes down to mathematical principles. That the movement of the planets or of the blood in the bloodstream or of objects in space obey laws of geometry that are completely permanent and that also equally true anywhere you are in the universe. Now that's not, I think, a very appealing vision of enduring truth to many people, and I suppose in many ways the novel and great literature such as Shakespeare provides us with these kind of handrails of truth that endure no matter what other type of turbulence occurs.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. One of the parallels I see is that the nature of science and scientific inquiry is patient, and it takes a long time. They don't just, find a little bit of data or a little fact and throw it out there in a journal. They test it. They create hypotheses around it, and they take their time. It's antithetical to this notion of real-time, instant data, and literature, as it informs our notion of the human condition, does the same thing. I mean, it takes a step back, and it does it at a more leisurely pace than a Twitter feed or a Facebook post. It's fascinating. The book is called Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. William Davies is my guest. We'll have more with Mr. Davies when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can also send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR and follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, from the pro-Brexit fallacy of an easy exit deal with the EU to climate change deniers to declarations of no collusion, no obstruction, we are living in an age where expertise and facts are often overwhelmed, at least in the political arena, by feeling and emotion. This is just one of the many interesting observations in the book that we're talking about today, Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. The author, William Davies, joins us from the studios of the BBC in London. You can join us as well, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and to send us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. So, Will, when you talk about the politics of feeling, you say that the demand that feelings and probability be taken seriously, whether or not, there's a diagnosis involved or science involved, it's really an insistence that narrative and memory matter with respect to problems that simply can't be told and assessed by experts. So how do we strike that balance between a respect for feeling and sensation and an acknowledgement that those are real emotions and the facts as we may also know them?
Well, this is an acute political problem. One of the problems of a sort of very fact-led politics is that you are telling people that your version of the past is the truthful one, and that potentially their one is not, and that has a kind of an insulting dimension to it. I mean, facts are necessarily about the past in one way or another. Now, I think that history can do a very important job in correcting false notions of the past, false notions of victimhood, and so on. But I think the one thing that history can do is to at least narrate that in some way, and to bring in stories, bring in a kind of sense of causality, bring in individuals, and to I suppose mediate between a sort of a kind of romantic but sometimes false nostalgia, and a very sort of I suppose rather kind of rationalist, cold view of how things have to be, and I think that it's the sort of a different way of trying to grasp time and history and the past in ways that are both honest but not necessarily kind of granting not necessarily sort of dismissing people's experiences is the political and I think also the scholarly problem that we face right now.
We have a tweet from WMF Stein who says, "The problem, as I see it, is technologically we've become as gods, but as a species, our judgment and emotional development is that of a 10-year-old. In short, we lack the wisdom to properly use the fruits of our technological knowledge and abilities." That's an interesting notion. I mean, are we ever going to be smart enough to be able to understand and really, you know, use for the right reasons the data and the facts that we've assembled?
Well, I mean, I think the anxiety that tweet points to is one which many people are very concerned of right now, which is that do all of these screens, which are offering constant updates and constant changes and are constantly swipeable, do they actually undermine our capacity to carry out slower, more deliberate, but ultimately more coherent ways of understanding the world? You know, are these screens and these platforms, are they triggering that 10-year-old mentality that the tweeter mentions by effectively sort of constantly luring us towards the kind of candy of the constantly flashing screen that can constantly change and constantly be swiped and so on? And I mean, there are these very real fears. There was a former Facebook insider who went public with his concerns that Facebook was, you know, trying to generate addictive behaviors, and that it was actually designing its various services and its user interfaces and so on specifically to try and create addictive behaviors, and that's the I suppose one of the sort of, I don't really kind of, you know, I'm not a psychologist, and the book isn't about this as such, but there is that Daniel Kahneman famously calls thinking fast and slow, where he talks about the different kind of psychological capacities of the mind, where you know, we have the ability both to think very carefully about something, to conduct a kind of an explanation of things, to reason through things, to think objectively about things, but we also have the capacity to instantly recognize someone or to jump out the way if a dangerous object comes towards us, and I think one of the, I suppose, if my book speaks to that at all, it's saying that it is about that you know, we have our ability to think fast, and the augmentation of thinking fast has increased hugely over the last 30 or 40 years, particularly thanks to digital technologies in everyday life. But then what happens to our thinking slow? Are we losing that capacity in various ways? And as a more pessimistic, that's already pessimistic enough, but a more pessimistic add-on to that is that thinking fast historically has been something that has been developed both as an evolutionary trait, but also has been augmented by technologies in situations of danger, conflict, and of warfare. And the sort of jumpiness or nervousness of contemporary society is explicable, I suppose, partly in terms of how much richer our capacity to react in real time has become, and potentially the capacity to actually understand things and to recognize how safe we are a lot of the time has gone down.
And as you say, it began with militarism, because a military general had to understand and react quickly to what his opponent was doing at any given time on the battlefield. And now we all seem somehow, you know, subconsciously obliged to react quickly to everything. And also, you write about the public spectacle of debate and the political discourse and crowds as a constant threat to the principle of reason and truth. You also make a really good observation that crowds are never the same as audiences or readerships or electorates. I mean, a crowd at a rally, a group of people, and this, you know, overlaid with this instinct for immediacy can be a really toxic thing.
Yeah, and again, this is all about the rise of real-time communication and reaction, which has been obviously hugely facilitated by the spread of social media and smartphones in the last decade and a bit more. I think, you know, this thing about real-time debate, I think, is an interesting example that you raise. And it's worth just, I think, remembering that the scientific revolution and contemporary science is specifically not real time. I mean, it's the delays are part of how science works, in the sense that you take time in order to produce an academic paper. It gets reviewed quite slowly. It gets checked, and then it gets published. It gets read. That the process through which objective facts are established and shared and become sort of institutionalized is necessarily a slow one. That process cannot be sped up without losing certain qualities of it. The same is true when you think about fact checking in the context of the media or something like that. Facts, by definition, and quite tragically a lot of the time, are slow to assemble and to check. Now, it's interesting, I think, that there is now this kind of valorization, this celebration of the sort of real-time intellectual, who is someone who sort of destroys their foes in combat, and the kind of staged debate of sort of Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson type figures it turns reason less into something that establishes consensus and establishes a common reality, and more into something that is kind of like a weapon that can be sort of used to kind of strike someone down in a sort of almost like a sort of jousting match.
One of your chapter heads is From Facts to Data. How did that evolution happen? When did we start moving away from facts and becoming obsessed with data? And what in your mind is the distinction?
Well, it's interesting. Data technically means that which is given. It's things that data includes the feelings. If you feel hot, your body is giving you data. Your nervous system is sharing data with your brain. If you hear something, that's data coming into your ears. But in order for something to be a fact, facts have a particular quality to them, which is that they are shared with others in a type of standardized form and can be checked in various ways. So facts are things which are laid on public record in some ways and are available to other people's eyes. That's what we mean by a fact, is that it's something that has a type of recording device that other people recognize. So if you say it's a fact that water boils at 100 degrees Celsius or something, that's something which has a common a recording device, a common measurement device. It's something that other people can check and can agree with. So facts, you might say, are agreement devices or types of promises. So you say, it is a fact that this happened. I can endorse it. I can get another witness to confirm it. Of course, there are kind of crucial moments where facts are vulnerable, like in courtroom testimonies or something, where someone makes a statement, and that's when you might require someone to put their hand on the Bible to make sure that this is actually the whole truth. But there is a kind of public quality to facts. Now, data, as we now understand it in the Silicon Valley sense, is something that is sort of scraped from various sources, from wearable technologies, from smart cards in various contexts, from credit cards, from use of the internet or something like that. But it is a constant scraping and mining. It is much closer to the sensations that we collect via our ears or our bodies or our nervous systems. And it is then kept in data banks where it can can be kept secret effectively. Yeah. It doesn't have that same quality of a public fact, and it also doesn't necessarily have the same standardized public quality that facts have. And that transition, which I think corporate power, particularly of Silicon Valley, has established, has really undermined facts in its own way.
Well, Will Davies, it is a fact that I was absolutely taken and fascinated by this book. This is a terrific read, and I really appreciate your writing the book and your taking the time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Tom.
William Davies is a political economist at Goldsmiths, University of London. The new book is called Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with Chris Wilson. He's the author of an amazing book, The Master Plan, My Journey from Life in Prison to a Life of Purpose. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop. They're on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults this summer. Baltimore Chef Shop will be offering classes in kitchen technique every Tuesday starting in July. And there's more information on the web at BaltimoreChefShop.com. Gift certificates are available. Future City is coming up next after an NPR news break at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.